Chapter 3. Under Ember. That morning, Dune had arrived at the pipeworks full of anticipation. This was the world of serious work at last, where he would get a chance to do something useful. What he'd learned in school and from his father, and from his own investigations, he could put it all to good purpose now. He pushed open the heavy pipeworks door and stepped inside. The air smelled strongly of dampness and moldy rubber, which seemed to him a pleasant, interesting smell. He strode up a hallway where yellow slickers hung from pegs on the walls. At the end of the hallway was a room full of people, some of them sitting on benches and pulling on knee-high rubber boots, some struggling into their slickers, some buckling on tool belts. A raucous clamor filled the room. Dune watched from the doorway, eager to join in, but not sure what to do. After a moment, a man emerged from the throng. He thrust out a hand. "Lister Monk, Pipeworks Director," he said. "You're the new boy, right? What size feet do you have? Large, medium, or small?"
"Medium," said Dune.
And Lister found him a slicker and a pair of boots. The boots were so ancient that their green rubber was cracked all over, as if covered with spider webs. He gave Dune a tool belt, too, in which were wrenches and hammers, spools of wire and tape, and tubes of some sort of black goop. "You'll be in Tunnel 97 today," Lister said. "Arlen Frohl will go down with you and show you what to do." He pointed at a short, delicate-looking girl with a white blonde braid down her back. "She may not look like an expert, but she is." Dune buckled his tool belt around his waist and put on his slicker, which for some reason smelled like sweaty feet.
"This way,"
said Arlen, without saying hello or smiling. She wove through the crowd of workers to a door marked Stairway and opened it. Stone steps led so far down that Dune couldn't see the end of them. On either side was a sheer wall of dark reddish stone, glistening with dampness. There was no railing. Along the ceiling ran a single wire, from which a light bulb hung every few yards. Water stood in shallow pools on each stair, in the hollow worn into the stones by years of footsteps. They started down. Dune concentrated on his feet. The clumsy boots made it hard not to stumble. As they went deeper, he began to hear a low roar, so low he seemed to hear it more with his stomach than his ears. It grew louder and louder. Was it a machine of some kind? Maybe the generator? The stairway came to an end at a door marked Main Tunnel. Arlen opened it, and as they stepped through, Dune realized that the sound he had been hearing wasn't a machine. It was the river. He stood still, staring. Like most people, he had never been really sure what a river was, just that it was water that somehow flowed on its own. He'd imagined it would be like the clear, narrow stream that came out of the kitchen faucet, only bigger and horizontal instead of vertical. But this was something entirely different. Not a stream of water, but endless tons of it pouring by. Wide as the widest street in Ember, churning and dipping and swirling, the river roared past, its turbulent surface like black liquid glass, scattered with flecks of light. Dune had never seen anything that moved so fast, and he had never heard such a thunderous, heart-stopping roar. The path they stood on was about 6 feet wide and ran parallel to the river for farther than Dune could see in both directions. In the wall along the path were openings that must lead, Dune thought, to the tunnels that branched everywhere below the city. A string of lights like the one in the stairway hung high up against the arched ceiling. Dune knew he was standing beneath the north edge of Ember. In school, you were taught to remember the directions this way. North was the direction of the river. South was the direction of the greenhouses. East was the direction of the school, and west was the direction left over, having nothing in particular to mark it. All the pipeworks tunnels branched off from the main tunnel to the south, toward the city. Arlen leaned toward Dune and shouted into his ear. "First, we'll go to the beginning of the river," she said. She led him up the main tunnel for a long way. They passed other people in yellow slickers, who greeted Arlen with a nod and glanced curiously at Dune. After 15 minutes or so, they came to the east edge of the pipeworks, where the river surged up from a deep chasm in the ground, churning so violently that its dark water turned white and filled the air with a spray that wet Dune's face. In the wall to their right was a wide double door.
"See that door right there?" Arlen shouted, pointing.
"Yes," Dune shouted back.
"That's the generator room.
Can we go in?"
"Of course not," said Arlen. "You have to have special permission."
She pointed back down the main tunnel.
"Now we'll go to the end of the river," she said.
She led him back, past the stairway door, all the way to the west edge of the pipeworks. There the river flowed into a huge opening in the wall and vanished into darkness.
"Where does it go?" Dune asked.
Arlen just shrugged.
"Back into the ground, I guess. Now let's find Tunnel 97 and get to work."
She pulled a folded piece of paper from her pocket.
"This is the map," she said. "You have one in your pocket, too. You have to use the map to find your way around in here."
The map looked to Dune like an immense centipede. The river arched across the top of the page like the centipede's body, and the tunnels dangled down from it like hundreds of long, long legs all tangled up with each other. To get to Tunnel 97, they followed a complicated route through passageways lined with crusty, rusted pipes that carried water to all the buildings of Ember. Puddles stood on the floor of the tunnel, and water dripped in brown rivulets down the walls. Just as in the main tunnel, there was a string of bulbs along the ceiling that provided dim light. Dune occupied his mind by calculating how far underground he was.
"From the river to the ceiling of the main tunnel must be 30 feet or so," he thought.
Above that were the storerooms, which occupied a layer at least 20 feet high. So that meant he was 50 feet underground, with tons of earth and rock and buildings above him. The thought made him tense up his shoulders. He cast a quick glance upward, as if all that weight might collapse onto his head.
"Here we are," said Arlen.
She was standing next to a leak that spurted a stream of water straight out from the wall.
"We have to turn the shutoff valve, take the pipe apart, put on a new connector, and stick it back together again."
With wrenches, hammers, washers, and black goop, they did this, getting soaked in the process. It took them most of the morning, and proved to Dune that the city was in even worse shape than he'd suspected. Not only were the lights about to fail, and the supplies about to run out, but the water system was breaking down. The whole city was crumbling, and what was anyone doing about it? When the lunch break came, Arlen took her lunch sack from a pocket in her tool belt, and went off to meet some friends a few tunnels away.
"You stay right here and wait until I get back," she said as she left. "If you wander around, you'll get lost."
But Dune set out as soon as she disappeared. Using his map, he found his way back to the main tunnel, then hurried to the east end. He wasn't going to wait for special permission to see the generator. He was pretty sure he could find a way to get in on his own, and he did. He simply stood by the door and waited for someone to come out. Quite soon, a stout woman carrying a lunch sack pushed open the door and walked away. She didn't notice him. Before the door could close again, Dune slipped inside. Such a horrendous noise met him that he staggered backward a few steps. It was an ear-splitting, growling, grinding, screaming noise, shot through with a hoarse, rackety-rackety sound, and underscored with a deep chugga-chugga-chugga. Dune clapped his hands over his ears and stepped forward. In front of him was a gigantic black machine, two stories high. It was vibrating so hard, it looked as if it might explode any second. Several people wearing earmuffs were busy around it. None of them noticed him come in. He tapped one of them on the shoulder, and the person jumped and whirled around. He was an old man, Dune saw, with a deeply lined brown face.
"I want to learn about the generator," Dune screamed,
but he might as well have saved his breath.
No one could be heard in the uproar. The old man glared at him, made a shooing motion with his hand, and turned back to work. Dune stood and watched for a while. Beside the huge machine were ladders on wheels that the workers pushed back and forth and climbed up on to reach the high parts. All over the room, greasy-looking cans and tools littered the floor. Against the wall stood big bins, holding every kind of bolt and screw and gear and lever and rod and tube, all of them black with age and jumbled together. The workers scurried between the bins and the generator, or simply stood and watched the thing shake. After a few minutes, Dune left. He was horrified. All his life, he had studied how things worked. It was one of his favorite things to do. He could take apart an old watch and put it back together exactly as it had been. He understood how the faucets in the sink worked. He'd fixed the toilet many times. He'd made a wheeled cart out of the parts of an old armchair. He even had a hazy idea of what was going on in the refrigerator. He was proud of his mechanical talent. There was only one thing he didn't understand at all, and that was electricity. What was the power that ran through the wires and into the light bulbs? Where did it come from? He had thought that if he could just get a look at the generator, he would have the clue he needed. From there, he could begin to work on a solution that would keep the lights of Ember burning. But one glimpse of the generator showed him how foolish he was. He'd expected to see something whose workings he could understand. A wheel turning, a spark being struck, some wires that led from one point to another. But this monstrous roaring thing, he wondered if anyone understood how it worked. It looked as if all they were doing was trying to keep it from flying apart. As it turned out, he was right. When the day was over and he was upstairs taking off his boots and slicker, he saw the old man from the generator room and went to talk to him. "Can you explain to me about the generator?" he asked. "Can you tell me how it works?" The old man just sighed. "All I know is, the river makes it go."
"But how?"
The man shrugged.
"Oh, who knows? Our job is just to keep it from breaking down. If a part breaks, we got to put on a new one. If a part freezes up, we got to oil it."
He wiped his hand wearily across his forehead, leaving a streak of black grease.
"I've been working on the generator for 20 years. It's always managed to chug along, but this year, I don't know. The thing seems to break down every couple minutes."
He cracked a wry smile.
"Of course, I hear we might run out of light bulbs before that, and it won't matter if the generator works or not."
Running out of light bulbs, running out of power, running out of time. Disaster was right around the corner. That's what Dune was thinking about when he stopped outside the gathering hall on his way home and saw Lina on the roof. She looked so free and happy up there. He didn't know why she was on the roof, but he wasn't surprised. It was the kind of thing she did, turning up in unexpected places, and now that she was a messenger, she could go just about anywhere. But how could she be so light-hearted when everything was falling apart? He headed for home. He lived with his father in a 2-bedroom apartment over his father's shop in Greengate Square. The small items shop, which sold things like nails, pins, tacks, clips, springs, jar lids, doorknobs, bits of wire, shards of glass, chunks of wood, and other small things that might be useful in some way. The small items shop had overflowed somewhat into their apartment above. In their front room, where other people might display a nice teapot on a tabletop or a few attractive squashes or tomatoes on a shelf, they had buckets and boxes and baskets full of spare items for the shop, things Dune's father had collected but not yet organized for selling. Often these items spilled over onto the floor. It was easy to trip over things in this apartment, and not a good idea to go barefoot. Today, Dune didn't stop in at the shop to see his father before going upstairs.
He wasn't in the mood for conversation. He removed two buckets of stuff from the couch, it looked like mostly shoe heels, and flopped down on the cushions. He'd been stupid to think he could understand the generator just by looking at it, when other people had been working on it their entire lives. The thing was, he had to admit, he'd always thought he was smarter than other people. He'd been sure he could learn about electricity and help save the city. He wanted to be the one to do it. He had imagined many times a ceremony in Harkin Square, organized to thank him for saving Ember, with the entire population in attendance and his father beaming from the front row. All Dune's life, his father had been saying to him, "You're a good boy, and a smart boy. You'll do grand things someday. I know you will." But Dune hadn't done much that was grand so far. He ached to do something truly important, like finding the secret of electricity, and as his father watched, be rewarded for his achievement. The size of the reward didn't matter. A small certificate would do, or maybe a badge to sew on his jacket. Now he was stuck in the muck of the pipeworks, patching up pipes that would leak and break again in a matter of days. It was even more useless and boring than being a messenger. The thought made him suddenly furious. He sat up, grabbed a shoe heel out of the bucket at his feet, and hurled it with all his might. It arrived at the front door, just as the door opened. Dune heard a hard thwack and a loud ouch at the same moment. Then he saw the long, lean, tired-looking face of his father in the doorway. Dune's anger drained away.
"Oh, I hit you, father. I'm sorry."
Dune's father rubbed the side of his head. He was a tall man, bald as a peeled potato, with a high forehead and a long chin. He had kind, slightly puzzled gray eyes.
"Got me in the ear," he said.
"What was that?"
"I got angry for a second," said Dune. "I threw one of these old heels."
"I see," said his father. He brushed some bottle tops off a chair and sat down. "Does it have to do with your first day at work, son?"
"Yes," said Dune.
His father nodded.
"Why don't you tell me about it?" he said.
Dune told him. When he was finished, his father ran a hand across his bald head as if smoothing down the hair that wasn't there. He sighed.
"Well," he said, "it sounds unpleasant, I have to admit. About the generator, especially, that's bad news. But the pipeworks is your assignment. No way around it. What you get is what you get. What you do with what you get, though, that's more the point, wouldn't you say?"
He looked at Dune and smiled, a bit sadly.
"I guess so," Dune said.
"But what can I do?"
"I don't know," said his father. "You'll think of something. You're a clever boy. The main thing is to pay attention. Pay close attention to everything. Notice what no one else notices. Then you'll know what no one else knows. And that's always useful."
He took off his coat and hung it from a peg on the wall.
"How's the worm?" he asked.
"I haven't looked at it yet," said Dune.
He went into his room and came out with a small wooden box covered with an old scarf. He set the box on the table and took the scarf off, and he and his father both bent over to look inside. A couple of limp cabbage leaves lay on the bottom of the box. On one of the leaves was a worm about an inch long. A few days before school ended, Dune had found the worm on the underside of a cabbage leaf he was slicing up for dinner. It was a pale, soft green, velvety smooth all over, with tiny, stubby legs. Dune had always been fascinated by bugs. He wrote down his observations about them in a book he had titled Crawling and Flying Things. Each page of the book was divided lengthwise down the center. On the left, he drew his pictures, with a pencil sharpened to a needle-like point. moth wings with their branching patterns of veins, spider legs which had minute hairs and tiny feet like claws, beetles with their feelers and their glossy armor. On the right, he wrote what he observed about each creature. He noted what it ate, where it slept, where it laid its eggs, and, if he knew, how long it lived. This was difficult with fast-moving creatures like moths and spiders. To learn anything about them, he had to catch what glimpses he could as they lived their lives out in the open. If he put them in a box, they scrambled around for a few days and then died. This worm, though, was different. It seemed perfectly happy to live in the box Dune had made for it. So far, it did only three things. Eat, sleep. It looked like sleeping, though Dune couldn't tell if the worm closed its eyes, or even if it had eyes. And expelled tiny black poop balls. That was it.
"I've had it for 5 days now," said Dune. "It's twice as big as it was when I got it. It's eaten 2 square inches of cabbage leaf."
"You're writing all this down?" Dune nodded. "Maybe," said his father, "you'll find some interesting new bugs in the pipeworks."
"Maybe," said Dune.
But to himself he said,
"No, that's not enough. I can't go plodding around the pipeworks, stopping up leaks, looking for bugs, and pretending there's no emergency. I have to find something important down there, something that's going to help. I have to. I just have to."
Chapter 4. Something Lost, Nothing Found. One day, when Lina had been a messenger for several weeks, she came home to find that Granny had thrown all the cushions from the couch onto the floor, ripped up a corner of the couch's lining, and was pulling out wads of stuffing.
"What are you doing?"
Lina cried. Granny looked up. Wisps of sofa stuffing stuck to the front of her dress and clung to her hair.
"Something is lost," she said. "I think it might be in here."
"What's lost, Granny?"
"I don't quite recall," said the old woman. "Something important."
"But, Granny, you're ruining the couch. What will we sit on?"
Granny tore a bit more of the covering off the couch and yanked out another puff of stuffing.
"It doesn't matter," she said. "I'll put it back together later."
"Let's put it back now," Lina said. "I don't think what's lost is in there."
"You don't know,"
said Granny darkly. But she sat back on her heels, looking tired. Lina began cleaning up the mess.
"Where's the baby?" she asked.
Granny gazed at Lina blankly.
"The baby?
You haven't forgotten the baby?"
"Oh, yes. She's, I think she's down in the shop."
"By herself?"
Lina stood up and ran down the stairs. She found Poppy sitting on the floor of the shop, enmeshed in a tangle of yellow yarn. As soon as she saw Lina, Poppy began to howl. Lina picked her up and unwound the yarn, talking soothingly, though she was so upset that her fingers trembled. For Granny to forget the baby was dangerous. Poppy could fall downstairs and hurt herself. She could wander out into the street and get lost. Granny had been forgetful lately, but this was the first time she'd completely forgotten about Poppy. When they got upstairs, Granny was kneeling on the floor, gathering up the white tufts of stuffing and jamming them back into the hole she'd made in the couch.
"It wasn't in there," she said sadly.
"What wasn't?"
"It was lost a long time ago," said Granny. "My father told me about it."
Lina sighed impatiently. More and more, her grandmother's mind seemed caught in the past. She could explain the rules of Pebble Jacks, which she'd last played when she was 8, or tell you what happened at the singing when she was 12,
or who she'd danced with at the Cloving Square dance when she was 16. But she would forget what had happened the day before yesterday.
"They heard him talking about it when he died," she said to Lina.
"They heard who talking?"
"My grandfather, the 7th mayor."
"And what did they hear him say?"
"Ah," said her grandmother with a faraway look, "that's the mystery. He said he couldn't get at it. Now it is lost, he said."
"But what was it?"
"He didn't say."
Lina gave up. It didn't matter anyway. Probably the lost thing was the old man's left sock or his hairbrush. But for some reason, the story had taken root in Granny's mind. The next morning, on her way to work, Lina stopped in at the house of their neighbor, Eveline Murdo. Mrs. Murdo was brisk in her manner, and in her person thin and straight as a nail, but she was kind in her unsmiling way. Until a few years ago, she'd run a shop that sold paper and pencils. But when paper and pencils became scarce, her shop closed. Now she spent her days sitting by her upstairs window, watching people in the street with her sharp eyes. Lina told Mrs. Murdo about her grandmother's forgetfulness.
"Will you look in on her sometimes and make sure things are all right?" she asked.
"I will, certainly," said Mrs. Murdo, nodding twice firmly. Lina went away feeling better. That day, Lina was given a message by Arbin Swin, who ran the Calais Street vegetable market, to be delivered to Lina's friend Clary, the greenhouse manager. Lina was glad to carry this message, though her gladness was mixed a little with sadness. Her father had worked in the greenhouses. It still felt strange not to see him there. The 5 greenhouses produced all of Ember's fresh food. They were out past Greengate Square, at the farthest edge of the city. Nothing else was out there but the trash heaps, great moldering, stinking hills that stood on rocky ground and were lit by a few floodlights high up on poles. It used to be that no one went to the trash heaps but the trash collectors, who dumped the trash and left it. Now and then a couple of children might go there to play, scrambling up the side of the heaps and tumbling down. Lina and Lizzie used to go when they were younger. They'd pull out the occasional treasure, some empty cans, maybe an old hat or a cracked plate. But not anymore. Now there were guards posted at the trash heaps to make sure no one poked around. Just recently, an official job called trash sifter had been created. Every day, a team of people methodically sorted through the trash heaps in search of anything that might be at all useful. They'd come back with broken chair legs that could be used for repairing window frames, bent nails that could become hooks for clothes, even filthy rags stiff with dirt that could be washed out and used to patch holes in window blinds or mattress covers. Lina hadn't thought about it before, but now she wondered about the trash sifters. Were they there because Ember really was running out of everything? Beyond the trash heaps, there was nothing at all. That is, only the vast unknown regions where the darkness was absolute. From the end of Diggory Street, Lina could see the long, low greenhouses. They looked like big tin cans that had been cut in half and laid on their sides. Her breath came a little faster. The greenhouses were a home to her, in a way. She knew that she was most likely to find Clary somewhere around Greenhouse 1, where the office was. So that was where she headed first. A small tool shed stood beside the door to Greenhouse 1. Lina peeked into it, but saw only rakes and shovels. So she opened the greenhouse door. Warm, furry-smelling air washed over her, and all her love for this place came rushing back. Out of habit, she gazed up toward the ceiling, as if she might see her father there on his ladder, tinkering with the sprinkler system, the temperature gauges, and the lights. The greenhouse light was whiter than the yellowish light of the Ember street lamps. It came from long tubes that ran the length of the ceiling. In this light, The leaves of the plants shone so green, they almost hurt Lina's eyes. On the days when she'd come here with her father, Lina had spent hours wandering along the gravel paths that ran between the vegetable beds, sniffing the leaves, poking her fingers into the dirt, and learning to tell the plants apart by their look and smell. There were the beans and peas with their curly tendrils, the dark green spinach, the ruffled lettuce, and the hard, pale green cabbages, some of them as big as a newborn baby's head. What she loved best was to rub the leaves of the tomato plant between her fingers and breathe in their pungent, powdery smell. A long, straight path led from one end of the building to the other. About halfway down the path, Clary was crouching by a bed of carrots. Lina ran toward her, and Clary smiled, brushed the dirt from her hands, and stood up. Clary was tall and solid, with big hands and knobby knuckles. She had a square jaw and square shoulders and brown hair cut in a short, squarish way. You might have thought from looking at her that she was a gruff, unfriendly person, but her nature was just the opposite. She was more comfortable with plants than with people, Lina's father had always said. She was strong, but shy, a person of much knowledge but few words. Lina had always liked her. Even when she was little, Clary did not treat her like a baby, but gave her jobs to do, pulling up carrots, picking bugs off cabbages. Since her parents had died, Lina had come many times to talk to Clary, or just to work silently beside her. Clary was always kind to her, and working with the plants took Lina's mind off her grief. "Well," said Clary. She smiled at Lina, wiped her hands on her already grimy pants, and smiled some more. Finally she said, "You're a messenger."
"Yes," said Lina, "and I have a message for you. It's from Arbin Swin. Please add 4 extra crates to my order, 2 of potatoes and 2 of cabbages."
Clary frowned.
I can't do that," she said. "At least, I can send him the cabbages, but only 1 small crate of potatoes."
"Why?" asked Lina.
"Well, we have a sort of problem with the potatoes."
"What is it?" asked Lina. Clary had a habit of answering questions in the briefest possible way. You had to keep asking and asking before she would believe you really wanted to know and weren't just being polite. Then she would explain, and you could see how much she knew and how much she loved her work.
"I'll show you," she said.
She led the way to a bed where the green leaves were spotted with black.
"A new disease. I haven't seen it before. When you dig up the potatoes, they're runny inside instead of hard, and they stink. I'm going to have to throw out all the ones in this bed. There are only a few beds left that aren't infected."
Most people in Ember had potatoes at every meal. Mashed, boiled, stewed, roasted. They'd had fried potatoes, too, in the days before the cooking oil ran out.
"I'd hate it if we couldn't have potatoes anymore," Lina said.
"I would, too," said Clary.
They sat on the edge of the potato bed and talked for a while, about Lina's grandmother and the baby, about the trouble Clary was having with the beehives, and about the greenhouse sprinkler system.
"It hasn't worked right since..."
Clary hesitated and glanced sideways at Lina.
"For a long time," she said.
She didn't want to say, "since your father died." Lina understood that. She stood up.
"I should go," she said. "I have to take Arbin Swin the answer to his message."
I hope you'll come again," said Clary.
"You can come whenever. You can come any time."
Lina said thank you and turned to go. But just outside the greenhouse door, she heard running footsteps and a strange, high sobbing sound. Or rather, she heard sobs and then a wail, sobs and then a shout, and then more sobs getting louder. She looked back toward the rear of the greenhouses, toward the trash heaps.
"Clary," she called, "there's something..."
Clary came out and listened too.
"Did you hear it?"
Yes,
said Clary.
She frowned.
I'm afraid it's someone who...
She peered toward the crying noise.
Yes, here he comes.
Her strong hand gripped Lina's shoulder for a moment.
You'd better go, she said. I'll take care of this.
But what is it?
Never mind. Just go on.
But Lina wanted to see. Once Clary had walked away, she ducked behind the tool shed. From there, she watched. The noise came closer. Out beyond the trash heaps, a figure appeared. It was a man, running and stumbling, his arms flopping. He looked as if he was about to fall over, as if he could hardly pick up his feet. In fact, as he came closer, he did fall. He tripped over a hose and crumpled to the ground as if his bones had dissolved. Clary stooped down and said something to him in a voice too low for Lina to hear. The man was panting. When he turned over and sat up, Lina saw that his face was scratched and his eyes wide open in fright. His sobs had turned into hiccups. She recognized him. It was Sag Merrill, one of the clerks in the supply depot. He was a quiet, long-faced man who always looked worried. Clary helped him to his feet. The two of them came slowly toward the greenhouse, and as they got closer, Lina could hear what the man was saying. He spoke very fast in a weak, trembly voice, hardly stopping for breath.
Sure I could do it. I said to myself, just one step after another. That's all, one step after another. I knew it would be dark. Who doesn't know that? But I thought, well, dark can't hurt you. I'll just keep going, I thought.
He stumbled and sagged against Clary.
Careful, Clary said.
They reached the door of the greenhouse, and Clary struggled to open it. Without thinking, Lina darted out from behind the tool shed and opened it for her. Clary shot her a quick frown, but said nothing. Sag didn't stop talking.
But then, the further I went, the darker it was, and you can't just keep walking into black dark, can you? It's like a wall in front of you. I kept turning around to look at the lights of the city, because that's all there was to see, and then I'd say to myself, "Don't look back, keep moving." But I kept tripping and falling. The ground is rough out there. I scraped my hands.
He held up one hand and stared at the red scratches on it, which oozed drops of blood. They got him into Clary's office and sat him down in her chair. He rambled on.
Me brave, I said to myself. I kept going and going, but then all of a sudden I thought, anything could be out here. There could be a pit 1,000 feet deep right in front of me. There could be something that bites. I've heard stories. Rats as big as garbage bins, and I had to get out of there, so I turned around and I ran.
Never mind, said Clary. You're all right now. Lina, get him some water.
Lina found a cup and filled it from the sink in the corner. Sag took it with a shaking hand and drank it down.
What were you looking for?
Lina asked. She knew what she would have been looking for if she'd gone out there. She'd thought about it countless times. Sag stared at her. He seemed to have to puzzle over her question. Finally, he said,
I was looking for something that could help us.
What would it be?
I don't know. Like a stairway that leads somewhere, maybe, or a building full of, I don't know, useful things.
But you didn't find anything? Or see anything?
Lina asked, disappointed.
Nothing! Nothing! There's nothing out there!
His voice became a shout, and his eyes looked wild again.
Or if there is, we can never get to it! Never! Not without a light!
He took a long, shaky breath. For a while he stared at the floor, then he stood up.
I think I'm all right now. I'll be going.
With uncertain steps, he went down the path and out the door.
Well, said Clary, I'm sorry that happened while you were here. I was afraid you might be scared. That's why I told you to go.
But Lina was full of questions, not fear. She had heard tales of people who tried to go out into the unknown regions. She had thought about it herself. In fact, she'd wondered the same things as Sage. She had imagined making her way out into the dark and coming to a wall in which she would find the door to a tunnel. And at the end of the tunnel would be the other city, the city of light that she had dreamed about. All it would take was the courage to walk away from Ember and into the darkness, and then to keep going. It might have been possible, if you could carry a light to show the way. But in Ember, there was no such thing as a light you could carry with you. Outside lights were fixed to their poles, or to the roofs of houses. Inside lights were set into the ceiling, or had cords that had to be plugged in. Over the course of Ember's history, various clever people had tried to invent a movable light, but all of them had failed. One man had managed to ignite the end of a stick of wood by holding it against the electric burner on his stove. He'd run across the city with the flaming stick, planning to use it to light his journey. But by the time he got to the trash heaps, his torch had gone out. Other people latched on to his idea. One woman who lived on Deadlock Street, very near the edge of the city, managed to get into the unknown regions with her flaming stick. But the stick burned quickly, and before she could go far, the flame singed her hands, and she threw it down. Everyone who had tried to penetrate the unknown regions had come back within a few hours, their enterprise a failure. Lina and Clary stood by the open door of the greenhouse and watched Sage shuffle toward the city. As he neared the trash heaps, two guards who had been sitting on the ground got to their feet. They walked over to Sage, and each of them took hold of one of his arms. "Uh-oh," said Clary. "Those guards are always looking for trouble."
"But Sage hasn't broken any law," said Lina.
"Doesn't matter. They need something to do. They'll get some fun out of scaring him."
One of the guards was shaking his finger at Sage and saying something in a voice almost loud enough for Lina to hear.
"Poor man," said Clary with a sigh. "He's the fourth one this year."
The guards were marching Sage away now, one on either side of him. Sage looked limp and small between them.
"What do you think is out in the unknown regions, Clary?"
Clary stared down at the ground, where the light from the greenhouse was casting long, thin shadows of them both.
"I don't know. Nothing, I guess."
"And do you think Ember is the only light in the dark world?"
Clary sighed.
"I don't know," she said.
She gave Lina a long look. Her eyes, Lina thought, looked a little sad. They were a deep brown, almost the color of the earth in the garden bed. Clary put a hand in her pocket and drew something out.
"Look," she said.
In the palm of her hand was a white bean.
"Something in this seed knows how to make a bean plant. How does it know that?"
"I don't know," said Lina,
staring at the hard, flat bean.
"It knows because it has life in it," said Clary. "But where does life come from? What is life?"
Lina could see that words were welling up in Clary now. Her eyes were bright, her cheeks were rosy.
"Take a lamp, for instance. When you plug it in, it comes alive in a way. It lights up. That's because it's connected to a wire that's connected to the generator, which is making electricity, though don't ask me how. But a bean seed isn't connected to anything. Neither are people. We don't have plugs and wires that connect us to generators. What makes living things go is inside them somehow."
Her dark eyebrows drew together over her eyes.
"What I mean is," she said finally, "something is going on that we don't understand. They say the builders made the city. Who made the builders? Who made us? I think the answer must be somewhere outside of Ember."
"In the unknown regions?"
"Maybe, maybe not. I don't know."
She brushed her hands together in a time-to-get-back-to-work way.
"Clary," said Lina quickly, "here's what I think." Her heart sped up. She hadn't told this to anyone before. "In my mind, I see another city."
Lina watched to see if Clary was going to laugh at her, or smile in that overly kind way. She didn't, so Lina went on.
"It isn't like Ember. It's white and gleaming. The buildings are tall and sort of sparkle. Everything is bright, not just inside the buildings, but all around them, too, even up in the sky. I know it's just my imagination, but it feels real. I think it is real."
Clary said, "Hmm." And then she said, "Where would such a city be?"
"That's what I don't know. Or how to get to it. I keep thinking, there's a door somewhere. Maybe out in the unknown regions. A door that leads out of Ember, and then behind the door, a road."
Clary just shrugged her shoulders. "I don't know," she said. "I have to get back to work. But here, take this." She handed Lina the bean seed, took a little pot from a shelf, scooped some dirt into it, and handed the pot to Lina, too.
"Stick the bean in here and water it every day," she said. "It looks like nothing, like a little white stone. But inside it, there's life. That must be a sort of clue, don't you think? If we could just figure it out."
Lina took the seed and the pot.
"Thank you," she said.
She wanted to give Clary a hug, but didn't, in case it would embarrass her. Instead, she just said goodbye and raced back toward the city. Chapter 5. On Night Street. Granny's mind was getting more and more muddled. Lina would come home in the evenings and find her rifling through the kitchen cupboards, surrounded by cans and jars with their lids off, or tearing the covers off her bed and trying to lift up the mattress with her skinny arms.
"It was an important thing," she would say. "The thing that was lost."
"But if you don't know what it was," said Lina, "how will you know when you found it?"
Granny didn't try to answer this question. She just flapped her hands at Lina and said,
"Never mind, never mind, never mind,"
and kept on searching. These days, Mrs. Murdo spent a great deal of time sitting by their window rather than her own. She would tell Granny she was just coming to keep her company.
"I don't want her to keep me company,"
Granny complained to Lina, and Lina said,
"Maybe she's lonely, Granny. Let her come."
Lina rather liked having Mrs. Murdo around. It was a bit like having a mother there. She wasn't anything like Lina's own mother, who had been a dreamy, absent-minded sort of person. Mrs. Murdo was motherlike in quite a different way. She made sure they all ate a good breakfast in the morning, usually potatoes with mushroom gravy and beet tea. She lined up the vitamin pills by each person's plate and made sure they were swallowed. When Mrs. Murdo was there, shoes got picked up and put away. Spills were wiped off the furniture, and Poppy always had on clean clothes. Lina could relax when Mrs. Murdo was around. She knew things were taken care of. Every week, Lina, like all workers between age 12 and age 15, had Thursday off. One Thursday, as she was standing in line at the Garn Square Market, hoping to get a bag of turnips for stew that night, she overheard a startling conversation between two people standing behind her.
"What I wanted," said one voice, "was some paint for my front door. It hasn't been painted for years. It's gray and peeling. Horrible. I heard a store over on Knight Street had some. I was hoping for blue."
"Blue would be nice," said the other voice wistfully.
"But when I got there," the first voice continued, "the man said he had no paint, never had. Disagreeable man. All he had were a few colored pencils."
Colored pencils? Lina had not seen colored pencils in any store for ages. Once, she'd had two red ones, a blue one, and a brown one.
She'd used these for her drawing until they were stubs too small to hold. Now, she had only one plain pencil left, and it was rapidly growing shorter. She longed to have colored pencils for her pictures of the imaginary city. She had a feeling it was a colorful place, though she didn't know what its colors might be. There were other things, of course, on which her money would be better spent. Granny's only coat was full of holes and coming apart at the seams. But Granny rarely went out, Lina told herself. She was either at home or in her yarn shop. She didn't really need a new coat, did she? Besides, how much could a few pencils cost? She could probably get a coat for Granny and some pencils. So that afternoon, she set out for Knight Street. She took Poppy with her. Poppy had learned how to ride piggyback. She wrapped her legs around Lina's waist and gripped Lina's throat with her small, strong fingers. On Budlow Street, people were standing in long lines with their bundles of laundry at the washing stations. The washers stirred the clothes in the washing machines with long poles. In days past, the machines themselves had whirled the clothes around, but not one of them worked anymore. Lina turned up Hafter Street, where the four street lamps were still out, and a building crew was repairing a partly collapsed roof. Orly Gordon called out to her from high on a ladder, and Lina looked up and waved. Farther on, she passed a woman with bits of rope and string for sale, and a man pulling a cart full of carrots and beets to the grocery stores. At the corner, a cluster of little children played catch with a rag ball. The streets were alive with people today. Moving fast, Lina threaded her way among them. But as she went into Otterwill Street, she saw something that made her slow down. A man was standing on the steps of the gathering hall, shouting and howling, and a crowd of people had gathered around him. Lina went closer, and when she saw who it was, her insides gave a lurch. It was Sadge Merrill. His arms flailed wildly, and his eyes were stretched wide open. In a high, rapid voice, he wailed out a stream of words.
"I have been to the unknown regions," he cried. "There is nothing, nothing, nothing there. Did you think something out there might save us? There's only darkness and monsters, darkness and terrible deep holes, darkness forever. The rats are the size of houses. The rocks are as sharp as knives. The darkness sucks your breath out. No hope for us out there. Oh, no, no hope, no hope."
He went on like this for a few minutes and then crumpled to the ground. The people watching him looked at each other and shook their heads. "Gone mad," Lina heard someone say.
"Yes, completely," said someone else.
Suddenly, Sadge sprang up again and resumed his terrible shouting. The crowd stepped back. Some of them hurried away. A few of them approached Sadge, speaking in calming voices. They took him by the arms and led him, still shouting, down the steps.
"Who dat? Who dat?"
said Poppy in her small, piercing voice. Lina turned away from the miserable spectacle.
"Hush, Poppy," she said. "It's a poor, sad man. He doesn't feel good. We mustn't stare."
She headed toward Knight Street, which ran along Greengate Square. There, a stringy-haired man sat cross-legged on the ground, playing a flute made out of a drainpipe, and five or six believers circled him, clapping and singing.
"Soon, soon, coming soon," they sang.
"What's coming soon?" Lina wondered, but she didn't stop to ask. Two blocks beyond, she came to a store that had no sign in its window. "This must be the one," she thought. At first it looked closed. Its window was dark. But the door opened when she pushed on it, and a bell attached to its doorknob clanked. From the back room came a black-haired man with big teeth and a long neck.
"Yes,"
he said. Lina recognized him. He was the one who had given her the message for the mayor on her very first day of work. His name was Hooper. No, Looper. That was it.
"Do you have pencils for sale?"
she asked. It seemed doubtful.
The shop shelves were empty, except for a few stacks of used paper. Poppy squirmed on Lina's back and whimpered a little.
"Sometimes," said Looper.
Poppy's whimper became a wail.
"All right, you can get down," Lina said to her.
She set her on the floor, where she tottered about unsteadily.
"What I'd like to see," said Lina, "are your colored pencils, if you have any."
"We have a few," said Looper. "They are somewhat expensive."
He smiled, showing his pushy teeth.
"Could I see them?" said Lina.
He went into the back room and returned a moment later, carrying a small box, which he set down on the counter. He took the lid off. Lina bent forward to look. Inside the box were at least a dozen colored pencils. Red, green, blue, yellow, purple, orange. They had never even been sharpened. Their ends were flat. They had erasers. Lina's heart gave a few fast beats.
"How much are they?" she said.
"Probably too much for you," the man said.
"Probably not," said Lina. "I have a job."
"Good, good,"
the man said, smiling again.
"No need to take offense."
He picked up the yellow pencil and twirled it between his fingers.
"Each pencil,"
he said.
$5.
$5? For 7, you could buy a coat. It would be an old patched coat, but still warm.
"That's too much," Lina said.
He shrugged and began to put the lid back on the box.
"But maybe..."
Lina's thoughts raced.
"Let me look at them again."
Once more, the man lifted the lid and Lina bent over the pencils. She picked one up. It was painted a deep, clear blue, and on its flat top was the blue dot of the lead. The pink eraser was held on by a shiny metal collar.
"So beautiful. I could buy just one," Lina thought. "Then I could save a little more and buy a coat for Granny next month."
"Make up your mind," said the man. "I have other customers who are interested if you aren't."
"All right, I'll take one. No, wait."
It was like hunger, what she felt. It was the same as when her hand sometimes seemed to reach out by itself to grab a piece of food. It was too strong to resist.
"I'll take 2, she said,
and a faint, dazzly feeling came over her at the thought of what she was doing.
"Which 2?
The man said. There were more colors in that box of pencils than in all of Ember. Ember's colors were all so much the same. Gray buildings, gray streets, black sky. Even the colors of people's clothes were faded from long use into mud green and rust red and gray blue. But these colors, they were as bright as the leaves and flowers in the greenhouse. Lina's hand hovered over the pencils.
"The blue one," she said, "and the yellow one. No, the...
The man made an impatient noise in the back of his throat.
"The green one," said Lina. "I'll take the blue and the green."
She lifted them out of the box. She took the money from the pocket of her coat and handed it to the man, and she put the pencils in her pocket. They were hers now. She felt a fierce, defiant joy. She turned to go, and that was when she saw that the baby was no longer in the store.
"Poppy?"
she cried. She whirled around.
"Did you see my little sister go out?"
she asked the man.
"Did you see which way she went?"
He shrugged.
"Didn't notice,"
he said. Lina darted into the street and looked in both directions. She saw lots of people, some children, but no Poppy. She stopped an old woman.
"Have you seen a little girl, a baby, walking by herself in a green jacket with a hood?"
The old woman just stared at her with dull eyes and shook her head.
"Poppy!"
Lina called.
"Poppy!"
Her voice rose to a shout. Such a little baby couldn't have gone far, she thought. Maybe down toward Greengate Square, where there were more people walking around. She began to run.
And then the lights flickered, and flickered again, and went out. Darkness slammed up in front of her like a wall. She stumbled, caught herself, and stood still. She could see absolutely nothing. Shouts of alarm came from up and down the street, and then silence. Lina stretched her arms out. Was she facing the street or a building? Terror swept through her. I must just stand still, she thought. The lights will come on again in a few seconds. They always do. But she thought of Poppy alone in the blackness, and her legs went weak. I must find her. She took a step. When she didn't bump into anything, she took another step, and the fingers of her right hand crumpled against something hard. The wall of a building, she thought. Keeping her hand against it, she turned left a little and took another step forward. Then suddenly her hand touched empty air. This would be Dedlock Street. Or had she passed Dedlock Street already? She couldn't keep the picture of the streets clear in her mind. The darkness seemed to fill not just the city around her, but the inside of her head as well. Heart pounding, she waited. Come back, lights, she pleaded. Please come back. She wanted to call out to Poppy, to tell her to stand still, not to be afraid. She would come for her soon. But the darkness pressed against her, and she couldn't summon her voice. She could hardly breathe. She wanted to claw the darkness away from her eyes, as if it were someone's hands. Small sounds came from here and there around her, a whimpering, a shuffling. In the distance, someone called out incoherently. How many minutes had gone by? The longest blackout ever had been 3 minutes and 14 seconds. Surely this was longer. She could have endured it if she'd been on her own. It was the thought of Poppy lost that she couldn't stand, and lost because she had been paying more attention to a box of pencils. Oh, she'd been selfish and greedy, and now she was so, so sorry. She made herself take another step forward, but then she thought, what if I'm going away from Poppy? She began to tremble, and she felt the sinking and dissolving inside her that meant she was going to cry. Her legs gave way like wet paper, and she slid down until she was sitting on the street, with her head on her knees. Trembling, her mind a wordless whirl of dread, she waited. An endless time went by. A moan came from somewhere to the left. A door slammed, closed. Footsteps started, then stopped. Into Lina's mind floated the beginning of the worst question. What if the lights... Never. She squeezed her arms around her knees and made the question stop. Lights come back, she said to herself. Lights come back. Come back. And suddenly, they did. Lina sprang up. There was the street again, and people looking upward with their mouths hanging open. All around, people started crying or wailing or grinning in relief. Then all at once, everyone started to hurry, moving fast toward the safety of home, in case it should happen again. Lina ran toward Greengate Square, stopping everyone she passed.
Did you see a little girl walking by herself just before the lights went out? She asked. Green jacket with a hood?
But no one wanted to listen to her. On the B Street side of the square stood a few people all talking at once and waving their arms. Lina ran up to them and asked her question. They stopped talking and stared at her.
How could we have seen anyone? The lights were out, said Nami Proggs, a tiny old woman whose back was so bent that she had to twist her head sideways to look up.
Lina said, No, she wandered away before the lights went out. She got away from me. She may have come this direction.
You have to keep your eye on a baby, Nami Proggs scolded.
Babies need watching, said one of the women who'd been singing with the believers.
But someone else said,
Oh, a toddler. Green jacket.
And he walked over to an open shop door and called,
You have that baby in there?
And through the door came someone leading Poppy by the hand.
Lina dashed to her and lifted her up. Poppy broke into loud wails.
"You're all right now," said Lina, holding her tightly.
"Don't worry, sweetie. You were just lost a moment. Now you're all right. I got you. Don't worry."
When she looked up to thank the person who'd found her, she saw a face she recognized. It was Dune. He looked the same as when she'd last seen him, except that his hair was shaggier. He had on the same baggy brown jacket he always wore.
"She was marching up the street by herself," he said. "No one knew who she belonged to, so I took her into my father's shop."
"She belongs to me," Lina said. "She's my sister. I was so afraid when she was lost. I thought she might fall and hurt herself, or be knocked over, or... Anyway, thank you so much for rescuing her."
"Anyone would have," said Dune.
He frowned and looked down at the pavement. Poppy had calmed down and was curled up against Lina's chest with her thumb in her mouth.
"And your job, how is it?" Lina asked. "The pipe works."
Dune shrugged his shoulders.
"All right," he said. "Interesting, anyway."
She waited, but it seemed that was all he was going to say.
"Well, thank you again," she said.
She hoisted Poppy around to her back.
"Lucky for you, Dune Harrow was around," said Nami
Proggs, who'd been watching them with her sideways glare.
"He's a good-hearted boy. Anything breaks at my house, he fixes it."
She hobbled after Lina, shaking a finger at her.
"You better watch that baby more carefully," she called.
"You shouldn't leave her alone," the flute player added.
"I know," said Lina. "You're right."
When she got home, she put the tired baby to bed in the bedroom they shared. Granny had been taking an afternoon nap in the front room and hadn't noticed the blackout at all. Lina told her that the lights had gone out for a few minutes, but she didn't mention anything about Poppy getting lost. Later, in her bedroom, with Poppy asleep, she took the two colored pencils from her pocket. They were not quite as beautiful as they had been. When she held them, she remembered the powerful wanting she had felt in that dusty store, and the feeling of it was mixed up with fear and shame and darkness.